I think those organizations are amazing. They're important. They're needed, but they are a band-aid approach to addressing food insecurity and hunger.
Food pantries are overwhelmed as the Trump administration holds back SNAP benefits during the government shutdown. Welcome to Carolina Connection. I'm Raina Drake.
And I'm Rachel Moody. Also this week, UNC has limited access to a lounge that students of color have used for over 50 years, leaving some feeling alienated. UNC School of Library Science and Data Science are merging, leading to concerns that the library side will be overshadowed. And a local group is trying to build community through wood turning.
We have spine surgeons, we have psychologists, we have welders, you name it, we got them. And they all come together, and wood turning is their central theme.
From the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media, this is Carolina Connection.
Thank you for joining us. As the government shutdown reaches its 40th day, Americans who rely on SNAP and other benefit programs are looking for any means to provide food for themselves and their families. This week was marked by legal battles. The Trump administration has challenged court rulings that would force it to pay partial SNAP benefits to recipients. Here in the Triangle, Table in Carborough is one of many food pantries trying to adjust to a substantial increase in need. Health experts say that while nonprofits do help some people, the aid they're able to supply is not sufficient. Liana Rieschi reports.
Right now, what we're doing is a special diet shift where we do cater to kids' special diets.
At a sprawling warehouse on Main Street, dozens of volunteers at Table gather each week to package meals for low-income Orange County children. Director of Marketing Suzanne Tormolin says Table has grown from helping 12 kids in one elementary school to over 1,100 kids each week. But even that isn't enough to meet everyone's needs.
In the spring of 2023, we did see our wait list get very large at that time. And we've never been without a wait list since then, but it has gone down. But as of this week, it's pretty much right around 300 kids.
Over the past couple of weeks, Table's wait list has only grown. As the record-breaking government shutdown continues, millions of Americans haven't known whether they will receive full, partial, or any benefits at all for November. Tormolin says Table has been hearing from families like that, but can't help them immediately.
At this point, if a family signs up for our program, it could be 6 months before we can actually let them in.
Many food pantries have had to tell people the same thing. UNC Health Policy Professor Lindsay Haynes Maslow says food pantries don't have the infrastructure to address hunger across the country.
I think those organizations are amazing, they're important, they're needed, but they are a band-aid approach to addressing food insecurity and hunger. For every essentially one meal that a food bank can provide, SNAP provides nine. So it's a 9-to-1 ratio of how much this program can actually impact others.
She says that food insecurity leads to vicious cycles of stress, poor health, and lower academic performance as children enter adulthood.
At this moment, those families are literally trying to do back of the envelope math on how they're going to pay their bills. They're going to have to start making decisions of, do I pay my rent? Do I pay my utility bill? If I have a vehicle, am I paying my gas bill this month for my car?
She added that restoring SNAP benefits can do more than just put food on the table for needy families.
This program is so vital and important. It can lift them out of poverty. It can reduce food insecurity by anywhere from, 13 to 15%. We've even had studies that show for every $1 invested in SNAP, $1.50 actually gets reinvested in the local economy. So it actually is good for economic benefit.
This is our walking pantry.
Back at Table, the organization says it's doing all that it can to reach as many families as possible. It's begun a new initiative during the shutdown that can help some of the people on the wait list. Local businesses like Brandwine's Bagels and Weaver Street Market are donating food for that. And Abby Warmick, Table's director of volunteers, says others in the community also are coming together to respond.
One of the farmers that we partner with was like super generous and gave us a call last week and just said, hey, something told me earlier this year that I should plant more greens than I normally do. And he was like, I'd like to donate them so that y'all can, get more food out to more people.
Tormolin says everybody in the community can help.
I mean, it's your neighbors, it's the kids that your kids go to school with. And so it's really continue to raise awareness for the need out there, and every little bit helps. So even if you can just come in and you pack three bags, that's three kids that get impacted.
But Professor Maslow stresses that food pantries like Table can't come anywhere close to solving food insecurity on their own. She says that SNAP is vital to addressing hunger, and Americans should hold their political leaders accountable when these programs are being withheld from them. In Chapel Hill, I'm Liana Rieschi.
In elections this week, Democrats saw big victories across the nation, with Virginia and New Jersey electing Democratic governors. There were also two Democratic upset victories in Georgia. That's a shift from last year, where Republicans dominated in many places. We're joined now by Michael Bitzer, a professor of political science at Catawba College, who gives insight on what this means for North Carolina politics. Professor, thanks for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
We saw Democrats winning big in places like Virginia and New Jersey, and even a progressive victory in New York City. From your perspective, what's driving this?
Well, I think it is certainly a referendum on President Trump and his policies. We typically tend to know in odd year elections like this year, and more importantly, in midterm elections for next year, the main kind of driver of those elections are going to be what is the opinion of the president, and more importantly, what's the status of the economy. And I think this year, with the president being underwater in his approval versus disapproval ratings, and with the Democratic candidates basically, you know, campaigning on the issue of affordability and the concerns about economics that Americans have, it really didn't turn out to be that big of a surprise, considering the numbers both in Virginia and in New Jersey.
So Democrats picked up around a dozen seats in the Virginia General Assembly, and our General Assembly is Republican dominant. Do you think the national Democratic momentum could carry over here to North Carolina?
I think that, you know, trying to predict anything a year out is very dangerous work for anybody, particularly a political scientist. But if this wave-like energy continues into 2026, and more importantly, you know, kind of going into September and October of next year, you know, the way that some of these districts are drawn, there may not be enough of a firewall to prevent a Democratic wave, you know, cresting over it. We'll just have to kind of wait and see what the dynamics are like. But I think, you know, some Republicans are probably looking at the map, and if they're around 55%, you know, Republican in their district, maybe they're wondering, is that enough of an insurance policy?
Do you think that this wave is a sign of long-term change, or is it more temporary?
I'd be very cautious to say anything is long-term in American politics now. So many of the voting blocs that cast their ballots for Donald Trump, that everybody was, you know, saying, here we are in the midst of a realignment, a real shift in voter behavior. A lot of those blocs went back and voted Democratic this year. So I think we need to be very cautious in terms of trying to make any predictions based on the swings of a couple of core groups until we get enough elections to say, yeah, the swingers have basically solidified into one camp over the other, or are they still bouncing back and forth just based on the election and the political environment of the time?
Thank you so much once again. That was Dr. Michael Bitzer of Catawba College. Thank you again for joining us.
Anytime. Good to talk to you.
Back on campus, UNC has revoked the Black Student Movement's access to a lounge that's been used by students of color since the 1960s. University administrators say they made the change to the Upendo Lounge to comply with new anti-DEI guidelines from the federal government and UNC system. Here's Carolina Connections, Emmy Berger, and Anthony Guerra Flores with more.
The Upendo Lounge is a cozy room that provides a safe environment for students. It is warm lighting, couches, and study booths meant to evoke comfort and focus. It's a space that the Black student movement has called their own for decades, a cornerstone meeting hub for many students who felt barriers attending a predominantly white university. The president of the Black student movement, Adam Sharif, says the loss of Upendo Lounge will be felt for years to come.
Meeting your friends, like being in a space where you can just sort of let go and be yourself, those are going to be missed out on. And those interactions are very, very important for Black students as they're going through higher education.
UNC alum Mitt McLean, who was a member of the BSM in the 1970s, says this space provided refuge for Black and Brown students.
It was great to have a place where we could go and sit down and talk about and encourage each other, because we knew that, you know, it was an uphill battle most of the time.
But McLean says it wasn't always easy to hold on to the lounge.
I think it was in 76, they were talking about they're moving us upstairs, and then there was talk about moving us somewhere else, but it seemed like it was always something.
Now, the lounge is threatened again. In September, UNC administrators said the room would become a conference space for university needs. Then, after student backlash, they said it will remain a lounge but be available to all students. In a webinar sponsored by the Carolina Alumni Black Issues Group, Chancellor Lee Roberts attributed the change to anti-DEI guidelines from the Trump administration and the UNC System Board of Governors.
The guidance we have from the administration, and this is what was communicated to the Black student movement back in August, you can't have a space that can only be reserved by certain groups.
But Sharif says the characterization of the Upendo Lounge is false, and a wide range of campus groups use it.
There's nothing facially restrictive about Upendo. Any org could use it. And there was no recorded instances of discrimination from the Black student movement and those who wanted to use the space.
We talked with the outreach co-coordinator of BSM, Tolu Wanimi Dapo Adeyemo, just outside the Upendo Lounge, where they said they can no longer get in.
It's always been one of my favorite places on campus, and it's especially always been special to me because this is one of the catalysts of my journey with poetry, and I'm always going to carry those memories of me having ERAP meetings in this room. And now, we can't get in.
Sharif says he doesn't want this decision to stop them from backing down.
Our first sort of response was to not just take this decision and sweep it under the rug. I think that would be a huge slap in the face to alumni who have advocated for this space, you know, cultivated their Carolina experience through the Upendo Lounge.
The Upendo Lounge brought feelings of comfort and belonging to members of the BSM, but also many other student organizations. Dapo Adeyemo, who is also the vice president of the Ebony Readers Onyx Theater, a spoken word poetry group for students of color, are now holding meetings in the general lobby of the Student Academic Services Building.
A lot of my most formative moments and most memorable experiences happened in this room.
Without the unique environment of Upendo, Dapo Adeyemo worries about the future of other minority students at UNC.
When it comes to one of my ultimate goals being to help Black kids reimagine success and opportunities for themselves, things like this make it so much harder.
Mitt McLean, the 1979 UNC graduate, went on to work in higher education for over 30 years. Now retired, she sees UNC's past reflected in its future.
We know it's not just about this space, you know, it's about where the university is headed. So yeah, we are concerned that, you know, if it's Upendo now, what will it be next?
At the Carolina Alumni Black Issues Group, Chancellor Roberts said the university has no plans to go after other spaces on campus, like the Stone Center, which focuses on Black culture and history. But many minority students see the changes to the lounge as a symptom of a growing antagonism on campus. In Chapel Hill, I'm Emmy Berger.
And I'm Anthony Guerra Flores.
Chancellor Lee Roberts has said that his big vision for UNC largely focuses on the university becoming a leader in artificial intelligence. Last month, UNC announced its School of Information and Library Sciences will merge with the School of Data Science and Society. And this new school will include AI as part of its mission. Department members were not alerted before, leaving many students, staff, and faculty concerned about the future of their programs. Maddie Policastro reports.
Let's see if the library's open. How about that?
Tucked in the first floor of Murphy Hall at UNC, Andrea Sun walks me through Ullman Library, one of the campus's lesser-known collections, novels, journals, and records. Sun is a first-year master's student studying archives and records management in the School of Information and Library Sciences, also known as SILS. Instead of attending a cheaper state school closer to home in New York, she decided to pay out-of-state tuition to come to UNC, where US News ranks the Library Sciences school one of the best in the country. But when a series of vague messages appeared in the graduate student group chat, Sun realized her plans might not be as straightforward as she anticipated.
What it was sold to me was an all-SILS meeting upstairs in Wilson, I guess on the main floor. I had things to do, so I was like, I'll just leave the talk now and pop by this, because I heard the words AI and I heard the words merger. I did not know anything beyond that.
This town hall meeting is where Sun, along with the faculty, staff, and other students at SILS, first learned that the program would be merging with the UNC School of Data Science and Society.
I was sort of filled with rage, not because I knew anything about the decision, but because I didn't like the idea that somebody had the ability and the control over my life to just make a drastic change without having any sort of preparation or any sort of emotional preparedness.
A statement from Chancellor Lee Roberts said the still unnamed school is part of the university's commitment to preparing students for a world increasingly shaped by data, information, and artificial intelligence. As a part of this transition, SILS Dean Jeffrey Bardzell will take on the role of Chief Artificial Intelligence Officer and Vice Provost of AI. Stanley Aholt, the current Dean of the School of Data Science and Society, will become the new Dean of these merged programs. Aholt says he and Bardzell were brought in to discuss how they could rise to meet the opportunity after the university leadership made the decision.
So we're at a specific moment in time where the technology is changing very rapidly. And as a consequence, we want to make sure that we, as a university, are responding well to the opportunity of the moment, much of which is being driven by large language models and generative AI. But certainly there are other factors involved as well.
Since UNC announced the decision, he says SDSS has been holding regular weekly meetings with both staff and faculty to discuss concerns as they develop the program structure.
We want to make sure that we do a great job of keeping the things that are unique in all of the programs that currently exist. We want to try to minimize disruption as much as possible.
Melanie Feinberg, a professor in SILS, says the Provost Operational Excellence team is facilitating this transition. The team told the department there would be working groups and an advisory board of faculty, staff, and students to facilitate the merger and field concerns. She says, however, the structure of the working groups is yet to be determined, making it difficult to get work done. Feinberg says one of the main concerns is that the department is currently short-staffed, and many staff members have taken on duties outside their job descriptions.
We would like to pay them in a way that matches the work that they're already doing, in addition to the work that they might be expected to do in relation to this union of two schools.
As SILS is already a small department, Feinberg added that many are concerned about maintaining the culture of SILS after the merger.
We also have a strong commitment to public knowledge and to the value of information for everyone. And we also want to ensure that the kinds of things that we do in terms of coursework, research, and other kinds of commitments to those values are equally valued in the new environment.
For Sun, she hopes the merger will bring in more resources for the department, giving them the ability to make a bigger impact both in the classroom and around campus.
I hope this means that we will have more to work with and that SILS will stop being an underlooked resource here at UNC.
According to the university, the new school is expected to launch in July 2026. In Chapel Hill, I'm Maddie Policastro. But I hate that it seems you were never enough. We were broken and bleeding, but never gave up. That's I hate that I made you the enemy. You're listening to Carolina Connection, the weekly student newscast from UNC's Hussman School of Journalism and Media. I'm Raina Drake.
And I'm Rachel Moody. On the latest edition of our Carolina Cast podcast, host Maddie Pellicastro dives into a new art installation in Raleigh's Dix Park. Thomas Dambo and his massive wooden trolls have invaded the park, spreading their mission of sustainability and community throughout the Triangle. The project director, Nick Smith, is excited for the installation to put Dix Park on track to becoming a destination park.
His whole narrative on his trolls is that they're all over the world, that once you kind of become a troll follower, that you want to visit other places and meet each of the different trolls, and we love being part of that story.
Thomas Dambo is an international recycled material artist and has recruited local volunteers in building these five wooden trolls. Reporter Marguerite Stuss took to the park to understand the community Dambo fosters and got a firsthand experience of what building these whimsical creatures looks like.
Dambo wants a net carbon footprint. After he's done all his traveling to the place where he's working, after materials have been picked up and food and all these other things that are creating waste are being brought onto the project, he wants zero of that to be, I guess, added to the ultimate emissions that come out of the project.
To learn more about the trolls, Thomas Dambo, and his sustainability mission, you can listen to the Carolina Connection podcast on our website, carolinaconnection.org, or you can subscribe to it on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Finally this week, in Chapel Hill, a woodturners group is doing more than just turning wood. They're building community. Gracie Durham reports on how the Chapel Hill woodturners are bringing together people from all walks of life to create, teach, and give back.
At a workshop in Chapel Hill, the air smells like sawdust. Each person is turning a block of wood into something new, like Harry Potter wands for their grandchildren, small vases, bowls, and Christmas ornaments. This workshop is the meeting spot for the Chapel Hill Woodturners Club. On a recent Friday afternoon, about 24 people stood in front of lathes, which showered the room with wood chips as members turned pieces of mahogany, cedar, and other species of wood. As they worked on their craft, members walked around the room exchanging ideas, guidance, and camaraderie. Frank Pinta, president of the club, has been woodturning for over 45 years.
This is a very special club in the country. There are about 376 clubs in the country. We're probably only one or two in the whole nation that actually has their own lathes. You know, we have 20 lathes and we actually teach woodturning.
Having their own lathes is just one thing that makes this club unique. Pinta says what really sets them apart is the people.
We have spine surgeons, we have psychologists, we have welders, we have plumbers, we have lawyers. You name it, we got them. And they all come together, and woodturning is their central theme.
That sense of community doesn't stop inside the workshop. June Seipel says they reach out to the broader community, donating handmade pieces through partnerships with local cancer centers and nonprofit organizations like Beads of Courage.
We turn very simple angels to, you know, just have something that you can kind of hold on to. It just sort of gives you maybe a little more strength, being that you're in the hospital, you're sick.
While their work brings comfort to others, member Terry Lefebvre says wood turning itself brings its own kind of relaxation.
When you leave here, you're refreshed because you've only focused on one thing and you don't worry about everything else that's bothering you in the world.
Anyone can attend the club's Learn to Turn workshops and experience this gratification for themselves. The sessions cost $25. And John Bianco says that people of all ages can enjoy the craft.
Two or three Fridays ago, we had what I consider probably one of our best days. We had nine new students, but of those nine, it was a set of grandparents that were watching their 12-year-old, 14-year-old, and 16-year-old while the parents were out of town.
Bianco was a veterinarian who started woodturning because it shared the same detailed precision as surgery. Bianco says he enjoys teaching new participants these skills and giving them a memorable experience.
The grandparents had fun. The kids were showing off their stuff. And I'm thinking at the end of the day, what kind of experience they're going to be able to talk about for years and years.
So right now, the specific part of the process that I'm at, which is really, in my opinion, the most gratifying, is when you put the finish on them and you buff them.
At her lathe, Rebecca Gunn, a member of the club, is shaping four small flower vases, each one from a different species of wood.
And so they go from looking like you know, kind of a pretty form and a nice pretty piece of wood to really like sealing the grain off and seeing what the grain can do. And so it's just the diversity of it never stops amazing me, really.
Right now, the Chapel Hill Woodturners occupy a rented workshop on Old Greensboro Road with about 20 lathes. But Pinta says their dream is much bigger.
We would love to have our own place. We want to actually start a school where we would be able to teach kids, as well as seniors, woodturning.
With about 60 members and growing, the club hopes to turn that dream into a reality. Learn to Turn sessions are open to anyone every Friday and Saturday from 9 a.m. until 2 p.m. In Chapel Hill, I'm Gracie Durham.
Thank you for listening to Carolina Connection. We are a production of the UNC Hussman School of Journalism and Media. We hope you enjoyed your time with us. Our technical directors are Kevin Paris and Kalias Galbraith-Fowl DeCanto. I'm Rachel Moody.
And I'm Raina Drake. There's more to be discovered at carolinaconnection.org. You can also find our stories on Instagram, Facebook, Blue Sky, or wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to weekend programming on 97.9 The Hill. We'll be right back.